Hello, and welcome everybody to our Venture Law Meetup webinar. This month we will be talking about connecting and engaging with investors. And with me today I have Marilia Campamisi and Rich Mazzola from Skoda Minotti, which is a local accounting firm. Both of them work a lot in the startup and emerging companies area in their practice as accounting, and I work as well in the startup and emerging company area in my practice as a lawyer. To introduce myself, I'm Leah Brownlee. I'm of counsel at Squire Patton Boggs, and I sit in the Cleveland office. I have a fairly good background in startup companies, having worked with them throughout my professional career, including about 6 years in-house at a startup company. And I'll let Marilee and Rich introduce themselves as well.
Hello, my name is Marilee Campamisi. I have been with Skoda Minotti for 13 years. My main area of focus is on the accounting and auditing side. I'm a principal with the firm. So in that regard, if a company should need audited, reviewed, or compiled financial statements for a bank or for their investors, we can provide that assurance that the financial statements are accurate. And since I've started with the firm, I have worked very often with life science and new technology companies, so medical device companies, pre-revenue pharma companies developing new drugs and in R&D going through the FDA process, and new technologies and softwares. And as I've worked over the years in this space, I tend to come across some companies that are more in the emerging markets, the startup realm, and have enjoyed working in that area. Over the past few years, I've also gotten to assist clients who have gone through regulation crowdfunding, and that is crowdfunding, getting equity from investors through a platform site such as WeFunder or SeedInvest. And these companies could be anywhere across the country, and they're really industry agnostic. So over the last year, we've sort of rebranded, relaunched our life science and innovation niche into this emerging practice niche that's really just focusing on startup companies in general that are fast growth and in need of alternative financing, non-bank type financing, where they want to get investors or grant funding from the government in that area. Over the last couple years, we've also been on the Innovation Council for the North Coast Angel Fund, which is a local angel fund in Cleveland. And we've also been participating with Jumpstart in their events, as well as Magnet doing some pitch competitions with them and being panel judges for companies there. So all of that has really tied into our interest in this space. I'll hand it over to Rich.
Yeah, my name is Rich Mazzola. I'm a manager in the emerging companies practice here at the firm. So in my previous instance with the firm, I spent about 5 years doing transaction advisory work. Three of those years were in Cleveland, Ohio. Two of those years were in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And while I was in Oklahoma, I spent quite a bit of time working out of a startup incubator while I wasn't traveling and doing some pro bono work with a lot of startups out of Oklahoma City, which they had named the Strawberry Fields or kind of the Silicon Valley of Oklahoma City. And upon returning back to Ohio, I ended up working with a startup in Akron, Ohio for about 13 months, focusing our attention on raising funds in the Series A, presented about 3 term sheets, after which I returned back to the firm and helped Marilee kind of kick off this emerging companies practice with a switched focus towards startups as a whole, vertical agnostic, and then helping them at various stages of development, you know, pre-seed level, Series A level, and in the growth stage, or accelerated growth stage. And in each of those different instances, which we'll touch on later in the presentation, our focus is to bundle those service offerings so that we can provide you with access to a larger firm to meet the budgets of the startups at those stages. So typically at pre-seed level, we're more dabbling in pitch decks, presentations, projections, and investor connections. And then as they continue to scale and grow, we'll layer in more fractional CFO, fractional controller, and fractional IT infrastructure as they scale and then assist with fractional CO work later in stages.
Thanks, Rich and Marilee. And just a a couple comments about the areas that I address in my practice. I guess my background, similar to Marilee, is very much in the life sciences. I'm more on the pharmaceutical side of life sciences, but I did go to school for engineering, which kind of brings me into a little bit of knowledge on the med device side. Today, though, you know, I do a lot of company-side representation, probably about 70% of my work, and those companies could range anywhere from starting that company to about 10 years old. A lot of, you know, and in that time span, we're approaching a lot of the same topics and the same issues as far as organization of the company, what we do with investors on the cap sheet, how to bring in investors, negotiating the financing rounds, and also kind of negotiating everything between investment rounds to kind of optimize the company for the next round of investment. Because most of the companies I work with, like what Marilee had said, are pre-revenue companies, and so we're looking really for the next round of investment as the product's being developed over a longer time span to become a revenue-generating product. Next, I want to just say a quick thank you to all of the co-sponsors for our event. We have 13 different co-sponsors around the city of Cleveland that help promote input on the events. We're on number 13 and going strong for the foreseeable future, you know, thanks to people like Rich and Marilee from Skoda Minotti bringing their knowledge and expertise and helping kind of push these events and the knowledge out to the listeners. So to the agenda of, you know, connecting and engaging with the investors, when I look at this, I think of generally three buckets of time and activities that go around a company going out and getting investment dollars in to the company. The first of these buckets we're calling setting the stage, and this is kind of the preparatory work before you ever call an investor the first time, and how do you organize all of yourself, but also how do you figure out who to connect to with investors, and what actions are you taking? The next item, once you figured out how to organize yourself, reaching out, meeting investors, what happens at that point in time, which is then followed by the follow-up to the investors and kind of pulling together the process of all of the steps that come up that we go through as you're getting to the point where an investor is going to write a check and fund your company's growth. So I guess to kick it off, maybe Rich, you can say a few words about kind of when you guys start talking to companies, what kind of help you give them. I know as service providers, you guys usually meet with companies a lot earlier than I do. And you had mentioned in the introductions helping with pitch decks and kind of that type of assistance that you're providing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think typically what we see, especially with folks at a pre-seed level, you know, just going out for their first time raising funds, relatively new founders, that they might have a pitch deck together, they might have a projection together, and they don't really have a pipeline or idea of where they're going to get their initial introductions to investors. So at that stage, typically, depending on the stage of their product development, we'd point them in the direction of an accelerator, a resource accelerator, where they can kind of get things buttoned up for free or with a very small fee. That allows them to kind of get a better understanding of what the market looks like for their product, what the value proposition looks like. And they can take all that information and come back to us with a probably a more robust pitch deck. And at that point, we make sure that their stories are aligning between both the pitch deck and the projection. The reason I say that is because most investors, if you as a founder are not verbally communicating as part of your pitch deck a question that they might have, they usually rely on the projections to feed the missing gaps in information. So as long as, you know, if you're saying, hey, we think our market share is X, and then the projection is Y and it's completely different, you know, that's going to raise some questions, Because in reality, they're going to be as much, they want to know how much you've planned as a founder, how much you've thought through this process, because they're investing in you as much as they are in your product, in your app or service. So I think part of that is really important, but also along with that is you got to, as a founder, you really need to set the stage for what the story is for you. And I say that because a lot of folks just, I have this idea, I have this widget, I'm going to go out and build it, and they have no idea what the market really looks like. And then this is where the term total obtainable market, total serviceable market, service obtainable market comes into play. And those are all different degrees. So if we talk about one market as a whole, it might be worth $10 billion. And then the actual serviceable piece of that, where your product or value proposition would fit, is only $1 billion. And then you're expecting, okay, out of that obtainable piece, what if we're at that serviceable piece, what is the obtainable portion that I'm actually going to go after? And once you figure that piece out, how are you going to target that? What's your sales cycle look like? All those questions kind of need to be addressed and understood in the pitch deck and the projections that need to align. But on top of that, it's really, you know, understanding in order to get there, to get to that sales cycle, to actually start introducing yourself to customers and making revenue, you know, really understanding what the value prop is, understanding how much money you need to raise from investors to get you there, right? So we talk about timelines. We talk about in your projections, you really need to understand, okay, it's going to be I'm burning cash or the burn rate at X amount of dollars every month, and I have this much in the bank account. So that means I need to get to investors at X date because my bank account is going to get zero. So I should really start talking to investors 6 months and further back than that. And that kind of helps align a timeline for when you really need to raise money versus when you need to focus your attention on sales. And I think that's a big balancing act that most founders struggle with. But on top of that, really understanding what, how much you need to raise, what those use of funds will be, right? Is it going to go to product development? Is it going to hire sales representatives? Is it going to be to purchase equipment? What are those uses of funds going to be? Because investors also want to understand and know that. And again, just how much of percentage you're willing to get take away from yourself in terms of ownership, and then what type of vehicle you're willing to use. So all those questions you really need to address and ask yourself before you even go and approach an investor.
So when you're talking about determining the total size of your market, does mm-hmm. sort of have specific tools that you can help your clients figure out how big the market is? And kind of help them answer mm-hmm. some of the questions that you're lining up?
Yep. So there's two different approaches, really, and the way I look at it, and Marilee, feel free to chime in if you have a different thought. Some of the most successful founders are the ones that actually have operated in the vertical that your startup is. So if a founder, let's just say, is underwater basket weaving, that's the industry they've been in, and it's this big market opportunity. But there's always been this problem with underwater basket weaving, and how are we going to solve for that problem? And that's why this founder comes up with this idea and then puts the startup together, and that's why they're going to go raise money. So when you have that type of knowledge, you have more of a robust and detailed-oriented understanding of what that vertical is, how big that market size is. Taking that knowledge and combining it with actual statistics online of what the total global market looks like, and then kind of bite-sizing it down into your region and your environment. So let's just say globally it's the $10 billion market size. And then you just limit down, okay, well, we know we're only going to really target North America or the United States more specifically at first. Okay, well, what does that look like? Okay, now that's the serviceable size. And then I'm going to say, okay, well, are you going to focus across all 50 states? Are you going to look at in Ohio or California or New York specifically? And then that helps you kind of slim it down to now more of a serviceable, obtainable piece. So I'm going to focus solely on Ohio. That's this big of the market share based on population or whatever statistic you know, you're using, and that kind of helps you level out, okay, here's how big the idea is. And I think in some instances, investors won't look at you as a startup unless you have a certain size market. So if your total obtainable market is only $1 billion, that's going to exclude certain investors out of your loop.
I also think that there's a lot of information just from public filings that you can do research for. And then we also have certain service providers that we would refer in to if a founder doesn't really understand their market yet and needs to do some research and wants some assistance with that. There's groups out there that can help perform that initial research, like Via Vera might be a good local contact. Mm-hmm. And then I think we've talked before about resources like PitchBook, and I think Jumpstart also has some resources available.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, my background's in the life sciences industry, so in the life sciences, I think this is a little bit different because we're not, I wouldn't say we're, you know, honing down all the way to Ohio or to a local or a regional market that's smaller than that. We're rather than that, in a life sciences industry, my experience, we're honing down on indications. So we are saying the U.S. as a market, but we're saying how many people within the U.S. have a specific type of cancer every year that's at a specific stage of development, say, past the initial therapy, that or fail the initial therapy, and that's how we determine what the market is. Like I said, Esmer Leek, you've worked a lot in life sciences. If you have any other comments that make it more specific to that industry, given I know in Cleveland we are very life science and healthcare centric for our startup marketplace.
Yeah, and I would say it's similar. So it depends on the what type of what problem they're solving. So are they, you know, reducing some kind of healthcare cost? And there's certain ways that you can research the markets out there currently, and if you would be possibly disrupting that market and taking over or solving that problem, then that could be used as kind of a comparable for what your opportunity might look like as the startup.
Thanks. And there's different resources depending on industries if it's your first time into the industry to help figure out what that marketplace is. I know we mentioned DiaVera when we look more to the health, the life sciences healthcare part. I know Cleveland Clinic Innovations has an outward-facing group that does exactly that work to help companies figure out their pathway and how much the market they can, you know, what the marketplace looks like for them. But,
yep. I think just to piggyback off that comment as well, I think another piece to take into consideration as you're doing market qualification is understanding the demographic you're approaching, meaning I think in New York and in LA, more specifically, B2C companies are more prevalent. And I think that using those two locations as focal points for a B2C brand-focused type of startup is important versus Midwest, which I think is more B2B in general. So understanding what region you're going to target and how that affects your overall market size as well is important to understand.
That's a very good point. So once you've pulled together your pitch deck, you've reached out to advisors, kind of pulled together something that you think will get somebody to pay attention and hopefully pull together, you know, pull in money to your company, what are going to be the next steps that you advise taking?
So, yeah, so once you have an idea of what your pitch deck looks like, where you're taking the company, how much you need to raise, answering all those questions, I think the big part is now we're kind of approaching this investment cycle, which I see as almost very closely related to what a sales cycle would look like with a customer. And I say that by when you're looking to sell something, you're going to develop some sort of target pipeline, understand what consumers I'm going to go after or what companies I'm going to go after, at least provide an introduction to say, here's my product, here's my widget, here's my service, here's why you're going to need it and can't live without it, and this is the opportunity to your business and this is why you should pay for it. So approaching a sales customer like that is the same way you're going to approach an investor. You're going to develop some sort of heat map or some sort of target pipeline for investors, and as you're kind of developing this pipeline, you're going to add an investor in, you're going to reach out to the investor, you're going to understand, you know, what type of companies they're interested in. Are they vertical agnostic? Are they focused on SaaS? Are they focused on life sciences, on pharma? What are the most recent deals? And doing general searches of those investors, you'll kind of populate what those deals have looked like and what companies they've invested in the past. At the same rate, developing what their size is, how much they've invested, are they hands-on or are they hands-off? Because that's an important thing. Do they want a board seat? Getting all those facts in line and developing this kind of target pipeline allows you to at least strategically focus on the investors that fit your mold. I think a lot of times founders like, just introduce me to investors, and anybody that wants to give me money, I'm going to take money from. In reality, it's not that simple because once you get in the room and you start talking to them, you know, maybe they want to be part of the management team. Maybe they want to be just on the board. Maybe they just don't want anything to do with it at all and be a silent partner. Can they provide you with access to, are they, I'll use the underwater basket weaving example, can they provide you with distribution channels in the underwater basket weaving environment? Can they give you introductions to more larger enterprise customers? Those are strategic investors that you need to kind of align with, and it might not just be a dollar amount you need to receive for X percent. It might be, I need a strategic investor, not just an investor. But once you have that developed pipeline, you go out, you pitch your idea, you see what feedback they're going to give you. I think a big part of that feedback is to sit there and listen to it. And if you don't have a slide developed or at least an answer in your head for a question that's asked and you're caught off guard, I think that's not necessarily a downfall. It's a learning experience for you. The best pitch decks are the ones that are 100 slides long, but you only ever show 20 of them. Because, you know, as questions come up in those presentations, you're able to go back into the appendix of your slide deck and pull one forward and say, oh, yep, we have that. We've talked about that. We've addressed that question or concern. Here's how we're handling it. Here's how that affects the projections or whatever it is. And once you pitch those ideas and you have somebody that's a warmed-up investor that's really interested in having further discussion, maybe providing a term sheet, NDAs are signed, non-disclosure agreements. That then provides them access to, a due diligence process. And I'll talk about due diligence in two facets, one being just general due diligence and the second being vertical due diligence. And when I talk about general due diligence, it's really talking about my operating agreement as a founder or with my founders, tax returns, customer agreements, vendor agreements if they're long-term, financial projections, financial results, customer lists to see if there's any customer concentrations. All those things need to be kind of populated and stored in some sort of data room. And I highly advise all of our clients to put that together immediately and continually update it. Because I can't tell you how many times it's been a struggle and it's been a time suck just to continually update those data rooms and add more files and take the files out. And it's a process, and it can be add stress to that situation. The second due diligence process is more vertical. So if we talk about life sciences or pharma, chemistry is a big, biology and chemistry are factors. They're going to bring in an expert in that particular field to investigate and determine if your product is viable. Same thing on the SaaS side. They might bring in a programmer to look at your code and make sure it's not a Jenga tower that's going to collapse with one poke. So those types of things, those are going to come into play, and that's separate from the general due diligence. Now, if you go through that process and all those questions are answered and all those, you know, problems are shown, I think one of the good tactics is to always, as a founder, review your data room. Because I think a lot of the times they kind of, okay, you go put this folder together, you go put this folder together, and then we'll compile them all, and there's our data room. In reality, the founder or those that are presenting to these investors really don't look at what's all in there. And they could be caught off guard by, you know, I had one case study where a founder did not look at the data room, and then when they were presented with an AR aging schedule or accounts receivable aging schedule, there's a big write-off 1 year from one of their major customers. And it was just business decision that was made by the management team, but the founder did not have an appropriate answer prepared for that discussion point, and it lost the investor because of it. So understanding what's in your data room, understanding where the warts are, I'll call them, or the blemishes or the problem areas, and then having responses prepared for them. Not necessarily, you don't have to be overly transparent and point them all out, but just having answers prepared because people will find them. Now going through that process, you're going to get better at it as it goes, and then as you continually go through that process, it moves on and you get the investors that are more warmed up and now they're ready to might sign an LOI or a letter of intent, which then moves them into a term sheet that says, here's the amount of cash we'll give you for X percent of equity and here's all the reps and warranties. And Leah, you're going to have a lot more input on those term sheets than I would, but it basically, you know, shows you what the deal would look like.
Yeah, so I just want to step back a little bit and thank you for the great overview, Rich. Just getting into the weeds a little bit, the first thing that you mentioned that really caught my eye, but is that heat map. To me, if you've never done a heat map or a list of investors, you might not really know what that means. And I think that, and it might sound, you know, difficult to pull together, but I guess to Mitch or Marilee, can you describe kind of what the heat map is? And it is a fairly simple document, I think, to keep up and maintain.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could do it. I mean, the heat map idea is just clearly identifying so you can have a clear overview of your investor list. So you could use red, green, yellow as, you know, your hot, your medium, and your, you know, don't bother with this team anymore because it's not worth your time. So any color indication that works best for you so that you have an easy way to identify who you want to follow up with in the near term, and it could be done in Excel or anything easy like that. It's a pretty simple idea, but I think effective.
Yeah.
And I agree. And, you know, I think a couple things to indicate, you know, in using your heat map, at least from my perspective, one of the questions I always like to ask a client when I am in, you know, very early on and, you know, even later in the stage is, what is the plan for the company? Where does the company want to be in 5 to 10 years? I would say more than 50% of the time, I get the answer that people want to sell the company. They want to develop an idea, have it get some funding, have it get some customer viability, popularity, and then have a strategic company swipe in and give them a lot of money. That's their plan. And those early stages in that heat map really starts to begin that plan, because if on day one, looking for your first investor, you know you want to sell your company by year five, you probably want to be having conversations with the strategic partners that may be buying your company and letting them know who you are, and they won't be ready to invest in you, so they might be a yellow on your heat map. And that might mean continuously follow up and keep them updated about where my company is in its development.
And I think that's a really good point, because there might be those that have shown interest but aren't ready to pull the trigger right now. But if you have a monthly newsletter that you can keep them on the list of, and if it's somebody that you really want to work with and you think would be a good fit, if you could just, you know, get them on board. I think we've talked about before, you know, finding out where they're networking, what events are they attending, and making sure that you're there and getting in front of them on an ongoing basis.
And a
another strategy.
Yep, and just to piggyback, I think a very easy way to do that is, especially if you're a SaaS company or you're moving to regulatory approval on the life sciences side, product updates can easily go out as newsletters, you know, hey, interested parties, here's what new features we've rolled out with our app, or here's our new service offering, here's a new logo we've just signed. All those types of updates are important to get out there because it forces those investors to then look at you again and take a second look. And they know you're updating them. They know you're looking at them. So I think that's all very important. And then updating that as follow-ups in terms of what's the latest follow-up you've given those investors on your heat map is important to keep updated as well.
Absolutely agree. And then we get into the investigation stage. I know you have in here the NDAs are signed. One of the big topics that we talk about a lot is that sometimes we get investors that will refuse to sign NDAs. From my experience, this is where we cross in a little bit with the data rooms, is if you get a professional-level data room, not Box.com or Dropbox, there's nothing wrong with those services, but the professional-level ones, they have click-through confidentiality. So the investor or potential investor can't see your documents unless they agree to keep confidential the terms, what they're getting into. And so that's always, you know, something to really think about investing in, and especially if you have investors that are pushing back on signing non-disclosure agreements.
Absolutely agree.
And I'm going to move forward a little bit, and this is more on the heat map, but it's that investor targeting idea. Mitch, you had said something earlier that there's, you know, some companies are coming out and they're saying, anybody that's willing to write me a check, you can be my investor, because what I need is money. But that might not be the most strategic way to go about getting your investors or accepting your investors.
Yes. Money is everywhere. I think the argument is, if you can find an investor that can open more doors for you, that is the better investor than an investor that might write a larger check for you. And the reason I say that is because revenue is almost as important as investor dollars, because you're not going anywhere without producing customers and making money. So the idea that I just need to get some large checks isn't necessarily the right mindset to have. I think the it's not wrong either, but I think the mindset to go into it is who can open more doors for me and get me further along. Because once that investor signs on, they want you to succeed as much as anybody. So they are going to almost be a free employee, quote unquote, to go out and find more connections for you. So I think when you target investors and you look at investors and what they're doing, experts in certain fields are important. I remember listening into a case study that described, I created my company and I knew exactly what company I was going to, or wanted to sell them to. So I purposely started operating within the region that they operated in, targeting customers and that they were targeting, working in their arena, and got investors along the way, understanding that my plan was always to target that specific strategic partnership at the end. And so by doing that and working their way in the same manner, I guess, methodology that larger company did, allow them to succeed and exit in the time frame that they had initially laid out for the investors. So by doing that and having that type of plan in place, thinking 5-10 years in advance, it's going to add a lot more weight to your story, a lot more weight to your projections, and you'll have a much easier time raising funds.
I think another consideration is the easy money may down the road may still cost you more. So considering a friend and family round, it might be one of the easiest ways to get some initial capital, and it might be the right fit for certain startups. But if things don't go to plan, it could also bog down the next steps in your operations, depending on the rights of those friends and family. And it might make things less attractive down the road when you want to get more serious investors. So just always keeping in mind that, you know, there's always a cost to fundraising and to getting capital, even if it doesn't seem like there is immediately. And you kind of have to weigh those costs and benefits.
Yeah, and I think another thing really to be cognizant about is how much time that investor will take to update, to kind of maintain the relationship with, and how involved that investor wants to be in your business. There are definitely investors that you want to have a lot of involvement in your business, and you want them to be hands-on because they're such experts in your field, because you have a great interpersonal relationship with them, you know, et cetera. But things can go wrong, and I've seen this within my client base where, you know, the Series A investor, in essence, killed the company because they wanted to have so many controls over how money was spent, and they had so little faith in management that they strangled the company and the company couldn't survive. And not only did the Series A investor lose their money, so did the founders and so did everybody else, although they had great connections. So, you know, being really well aware of the personalities of the investors and making sure that that's who you want to be your partner in your business, because an early investor is going to be around for a while. So whether it's a 5-year exit or a 10-year exit, they're going to be part of your life or your professional life for several years down the line. And they're going to need to understand what you're doing to kind of add value to them, but you're also going to have to be able to be honest with them if business, you know, doesn't go as planned, and go through the ups and downs with the investors that you take on.
Yep. The online search engine is your best friend when you're getting close to a term sheet with an investor, you know, looking up their backstory, what deals have they done in the past, have there been any horror stories, you know, anything like that.
Right. And as a service provider, we actually provide that type of service to our clients for free, so you know the name of the investor that you're interested in signing a term sheet in. Squire has 1,500 lawyers around the world. We'll send an email out to the right region and say, like, has anybody ever heard of this company or this person, and see if we can get some reputation information back.
That's awesome.
So, you know, I think we've gone through the developing of the pipeline already. And, you know, turning next to kind of in the middle of, you have a pipeline of investors you want to meet, you've networked, you've created a list, you've prioritized it, you've started meeting with them. You know, I guess we're right in that bucket of what's happening in the middle of the investor meeting.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I touched on it before. I think, rejection is inevitable in these, you're signing up to be a founder, you're going to get rejected at some turns. But I think taking that rejection and understanding why that investor rejected you, and if it's a case where, and I think this can get muddy, but I think if it's a case where they had constructive feedback that wasn't core to your business or your plan, I think that type of criticism you can take, but you don't necessarily need to pivot on unless it's crucial. But I do think that if there is a communication barrier or a messaging issue, that constructive feedback, that's easily corrected. That's where I talked about having the best presentations or pitch decks have 100 slides. That's where you take any of those constructive feedback messaging issues and you create a slide to address it because you've thought through that issue, you've thought through the plan, you thought how we're going to address it. And you just present it as if it's another fact, right? Here it is. Here's the plan if we ever come into this issue or this barrier. And that just resolves that issue and removes that barrier for you in the future. So I think having those conversations, getting rejected, taking the feedback, correcting your pitch deck or adjusting where you need to, fine-tuning your projections if that's the case, and then getting back out there and doing it again. I think that's all important. But I think the main fact here is that being coachable is extremely important. Investors want to see that you can move and pivot, and if you have like, here's my grand plan, and if it doesn't go according to this plan, we're done. I think the ability for you to take two steps forward and then take a step back to then pivot is important, and be coachable and understanding that things will change in the future, and keeping your investors updated, and again, they're investing as much in you as they are in the product or service.
And there's a lot of opinions out there from investors, and I think investors ultimately want to be heard. And so not necessarily to Rich's point, you don't have to change your business plans to reflect their concerns, but at least listen to them and take them into consideration so that the investors feel like they've been heard. And I've seen a few pitches before where if the founder doesn't have a clear path, if they're too willing to adjust to different ideas, it gets too muddy, and then the investors are confused about the direction of the company. So even if you like an idea that an investor has, consider it, but you need to at least draw a line in the sand and say, at this point, at this time of the business, here's the direction that we're going in until we come to a place where it's going to require a pivot. So making sure that the messaging stays clear, even though you're considering some other options.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the one thing I'll layer on top of that is I think meeting with investors and going through the whole process over and over again, because you really will meet, you know, 30, 40, maybe 100 different investor meetings to get your first round closed. It's very much a roller coaster. And the better you can do at kind of staying above it and being strategic and objective, the better you'll do on that. Because almost everybody you meet with will not be the right investor for you, whether you reject them or more often they reject you because you're not the right fit for their investor dollars. And then, you know, everybody has great intentions and giving you good advice, and you should probably ignore most of it if you have a really good core plan of what your company is going to do. And you should be able to pick out the bits that really are important to pivot and change, to improve your presentation and your delivery, and hopefully improve your ability to get investment dollars.
I was just going to say two things that I would say for any pitch that you're giving to potential investors. One, I would ask, if the messaging, at the end, ask for feedback. So did the messaging fall down at some point that it could be clearer, or any questions that need to be answered? Maybe it's an easy fix to get the investor on board. So asking for honest feedback from your investors so that you can improve the messaging to make sure it's clear, and then also asking for referrals. So if this investor is not the right fit, maybe they know somebody who is. So making the best use of that time on all sides to get, you know, further down the road to the right connection.
I agree. So what I was going to say, also, the objective of the first meeting with an investor is to get a second meeting. It's not necessarily to get a check. It's to continue the conversation. And, you know, I meet with a lot of founders that are really excited because they've had these great conversations and they are certain they have, those conversations will turn into investment dollars. But until the moment that the investor is willing to sign a non-disclosure agreement, you shouldn't count them in the camp of serious investor that's going to give you money, because that's when you know they're serious, that they're sending it to their legal team, they're making sure, and they're taking the risk of looking at your confidential materials and going into the due diligence process with you. So they're committing their time, their energy to look at you even closer. And, you know, I'll let Rich and Marilee say a few words about what they see from the due diligence process with their clients and how they coach them through it.
Yep. So I touched on this quite a bit before, but again, just reiterating general due diligence versus vertical specific due diligence. Make sure you just have the right folks in the room. So whoever your developers were, make sure they're in the room, even if they're service providers. So a lot of the times our clients will ask us to help them put projections together, and that's perfectly fine. We'll put those together, and then they need us in the room when they meet with investors. So we'll act as that fractional CFO, as if we work there to help them kind of describe the projection and walk them through the assumptions, because there are going to be guesses in those projections. So walking through the assumptions, making sure the investors are aligned with those, and make sure it aligns with the story. But having those service providers in the room adds an extra bit of weight to the understanding, so that you're not, required to speak on everyone's behalf, and that allows you to kind of spread your resources effectively during those discussions or later discussions of due diligence. Pre-seed level due diligence is a lot lighter than those that are at Series A and later on. It just depends on what financial history you have there to dig into, how detailed and complex your product and service is, and that in effect would make the projections and pitches more detailed. But going through the due diligence, understanding your projections, we always like to work from the revenue side down, meaning we start with our sales target pipelines. We factor in our projection and growth assumptions. That factors in, forces you to think about hiring. So if we're making this much revenue, where is it coming from? Well, we need this many sales reps, this many marketing folks, this many developers to continue product development, whatever it is. That'll help you align that. You factor in your operating budgets, your general business plan. You can layer in a factor of the market analysis research, and then you just provide a competitive analysis. And just to drive a little more detail, and Marilee, feel free to chime in here too, but on the competitive analysis side, a lot of the times I see we have no competitors in the space. We're the first here, and that might not necessarily be true. So I would encourage founders to really take a hard look at their competitive analysis and understand what technical competitors are out there. Maybe they're not the perfect fit, but what are they offering that you aren't? Because I think that adds a lot more weight to competitive analysis, and I've heard a lot of good feedback from investors when that's happened, to show, hey, here's widget ABC, here's what they can do. Oh, by the way, we have a competitor that has widget D, and this is why we don't have it, or maybe it's in our future, but we will pivot on that and adjust and make it even better. But having that in there kind of aligns with, we've thought through this market, we've thought through who's out there playing in this space, and this is why we're going to beat them. And I think that adds a lot more weight.
Thanks. And from my perspective, on the legal service provider, I'm almost never in the initial investor meeting, and I'm almost never involved with the potential investor until we get to a signed term sheet level. And a lot of due diligence has happened before the signed term sheet. Usually those initial investor meetings, financial projections, a little bit of information about the legal side of the house, though not a lot before a term sheet signed on the legal side of things. But once once you've identified the investor, you've signed an NDA, you've had, you know, investor meetings and kind of met a threshold that that investor is willing to give you a term sheet, then we have, you know, a data room, we have legal documents, and we might have a data room earlier that's staged so that some documents come out before a term sheet and some documents come out after a term sheet. And I guess the next thing is, you know, I said really quickly before, not Box.com, not Dropbox. I have plenty of data rooms that I get access to that are on both of those platforms. There's nothing logistically wrong about it, but in the high tech, in the life sciences business, the thing that creates the value for your company and the value that the investors are investing in is very typically your intellectual property. And so going with a data room platform that's more protective and has more bells and whistles to protect the intellectual property is something I always advise to spend a little bit of money on. And, you know, once you get that platform, what do you put in that data room? And what are the investors looking at when they're going through your documents? It may, Maralia, do you coach companies through putting up their data room? Maybe you can walk us through that part.
Yeah, I mean, I think depending on the level of the stage of the company and the investor, it varies a little bit, but consistently, I always think all of your permafile documents, like any legal documents typically you want to include in the data room because the investors are going to want to know about any commitments, agreements, contracts, things of that nature. Definitely any patents or anything that's protecting the knowledge of the value of the company. We've helped assist clients with this process, and we've kind of used our own ShareFile site that we've used, which probably isn't as quite as fancy as some of the ones that you've talked about, Leah. But then more so, we help a lot on the financial side, making sure that the story makes sense. If there's assumptions in there with projections and forecasting, we make sure that those are clearly identified and the support is in there. The research that's been done is included in that data room. So I would say the bigger focus that I've had experience with has been on the financial side and making sure that everything is buttoned down, looks good. A lot of times the ones that we're working on, the investors want at a minimum accrual basis accounting, if not GAAP. So making sure that if they've been historically on the cash basis, that those adjustments have been made to include any accruals, liabilities that maybe historically haven't been booked that need to be included.
And then from my perspective on the legal side, the foundational documents of the company, whether it's operating agreements or bylaws, the intellectual property filings, if you have registered, filed intellectual property. A lot of that's publicly accessible, so just a list of it rather than copies of the full applications can be sufficient. Also, if it's very, you know, research-based type of company, any peer, you know, peer-reviewed publications that support your technology and say, in essence, how innovative it is and give more information about it is helpful. Contacts with vendors, bigger vendors. I would never say don't put your coffee machine contract in there. Nobody cares. But do put your lease agreement in there, or if you're prototyping products with a specific vendor, those are all very important. Employment agreements. This would be the offer letters. If you use the same form for every employee, you only need to put the form in there. Also, every single employee should sign an employee confidentiality and proprietary rights agreement where the employee agrees to keep your information confidential and agrees to assign any inventions to the company. That's going to be a number one focus for an investor coming in, and I see in a lot of agreements that I work on a covenant that every single employee, you know, has to sign one in the future, and a representation that every employee or contractor that's ever been involved in the product development has appropriately assigned their rights to intellectual property. So this is one of the biggest things to get right when setting up your company. And then, you know, any other regular kind of legal stuff, hopefully at this stage of investment there's no litigation, but if there has been any litigation, it's one of those warts that you have to be open and honest about, and not hide from investors. And you should be ready that people are going to pour through the documents and they're going to ask a lot of questions, and there's going to be calls specifically, you know, asking about different components of the documents, whether it's how your stock was issued in the past, or walking through the financials, or walking through why your intellectual property is different than better than a competitor's intellectual property. All of those discussions will be had. And then we get to some of those discussions are going to be very vertically specific. And some of the due diligence will be as well. So maybe Rich can say a few words about how the vertical due diligence differs across industries.
Yeah, and I'll speak more to the SaaS side just because I've seen a little bit more of that. But the, you know, when you're talking about vertical specific due diligence, they're really driving into the code, understanding the database support systems behind it, understanding how the data is being stored, how it's based on the cloud, is it Microsoft Azure, is it Amazon Web Services, and then understanding how the product rolls out and how that specific app may store data from a security privacy standpoint, or from a how much data does it use, anything like that, anything where it's they're going to poke holes in the code itself and then provide some feedback to say, okay, why did you design it this way or versus this way? And they're going to ask questions around that. I think from a life science perspective, it's more based on the product and then where the trials are. If it's a pharma specific startup, you know, where the trials are with animal testing, what the results have looked like.
I think if you've received any grants and done any compliance work around that, if you've done any studies on behalf of the government, that adds a lot of value to your track record and to the process. But, yeah, definitely status updates on where you are with the FDA process or what the plan is, whether you can do a 510K or something like that and have maybe a faster process going through FDA than some of the others. But, yeah, just making sure that you've got the scientists behind that can answer all of those nitty-gritty questions.
I agree. And, you know, there's going to be times that investors are overreaching. So while investors will do a deep dive, typically before they give you money and make sure they really believe not only in your product but also in your management team, there are times that they will ask for too much. And, you have to be aware of that and make sure and be comfortable in saying no. It doesn't necessarily match nationality, but my most recent case, less than a month ago, is a Chinese investor coming in saying, we're going to send somebody to your location. Please have the lab notebooks out that you wrote down all of your chemistry in as it was being invented. And the answer is no. Like, what's the nicest possible way for us to tell you, no, you can't have the secret sauce?
Too much.
So, you have to be wary. You should expect a lot of questions, but there are boundaries that investors shouldn't cross, and they should raise your antenna if they ask too many questions.
Absolutely.
And I mentioned a little bit about the management team as well, as I just mentioned. One thing about early on investors is they're investing in two things. They're investing, one, in your product, but primarily they're investing in their belief that the management team can bring that product to market. And so one of the components of the due diligence at this level very well may be in-depth background searches of the management. So before they give you money, they may be ordering, you know, professional background searches to be done by all the to be done for all of the management team, and just making sure that there aren't things in the background of the management team that would cause them to not want to invest in the company, especially if they've never met that management team before or it wasn't referred to them by a friendly source.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it adds a lot more weight, especially in those initial introductions or biographies when you display those to investors, if the management team has had prior startup experience. I think just the culture, the speed at which you move and pivot, it takes a very special personality to be in that role. So having that type of background adds a little more credibility and weight to your management team if they've done it before, at least worked at it, if not managed in it.
No, and I agree. And I think depending on what industry you're in, just your credentials is going to be very weighty. And if you don't have the appropriate credentials, it's going to be a hurdle to get over. So if you're in the life sciences industry and you're a founder that doesn't have a PhD, you should know going in that that's something that's going to be addressed at some point in time, most likely. And I guess other things that investors are going to ask for, and really you should be aware of how much details you give and who those investors are, the customer list. If you're going with a strategic investor that's also in your industry, you may want to hold back on how much of the information into who your customers are you're willing to give until a later round of due diligence when it looks like they're very committed to becoming an investor. And some investors will ask for an introduction to your customer prior to the closing of an investment round, which is almost never appropriate. And often we schedule those type of conversations right after the closing of a round. And so that's a lot about, like, the information that you're giving to investors after you've identified with them, after you've engaged with them, you know, stepping back a little bit. One thing we haven't really addressed is that in an investment round, you're probably doing this with 3 to 10 different investors. And you're not going to have that many people super highly engaged, but you're going to have a lead investor at some point that then becomes responsible for the group of investors and doing the due diligence. Even though the other investors are going to be doing a little bit of diligence themselves, but that lead investor is going to be negotiating the terms and really reacting to the due diligence finds with requests in the investment documents. And then, you know, as we close out our hour, I just want to ask Rich and Marilee if they want to say a few things kind of to the potential companies out there and how to be best prepared and kind of optimize for success.
Yeah, one of the things I think is most important is being able to have, and I'm an accountant, so I go back to the numbers, but being able to clearly identify how much money you're looking to raise and how far that's going to get you. So is it going to get you to a point of break even? Is it going to get your product through the FDA process? Is it going to get you to scale? And being able to tell that story and then have the numbers to support that so that the investors have a clear idea of where their money is going, what the funds are going to be used for, and so that you can keep them updated throughout that process that you're meeting those targets to get to that point in the company where either you're going to need follow-on investing or maybe looking to exit, or the company might be sustainable on their own and making profits now and putting out dividends. So to me, I think that's one of the most important items in your presentation.
Yeah, I think I'll split it between the two stages. So I'll just speak more or less to pre-seed and then later stage investing. So the pre-seed level, I think just, and this has obviously been said before, but practice makes perfect. Can you do your pitch without over a cup of coffee with interruptions without having the slide deck behind you? Can you ramble through it and really show confidence and you know, you understand your plan, your market space, what your product's going to do, and what the plan is and how you're going to execute that plan? I think that's just showing that confidence is key, and being able to run through your pitch deck without interruption is crucial at that point. From a later stage company, understanding historic financial information, because the historics is the road, historic financial statements are the roadmap for your plan, meaning where have you walked in the past? So they're going to look to that and say, like, what was your original business plan? What, where, why did you pivot? What happened? Why is, are the financials the way they are today? And how is that going to impact your future plan? I think understanding what you did, what went wrong, how you pivoted, how you addressed it, and how you came out better for it at the end, I think understanding that financial history is very important at that stage as well.
Yeah, thanks to both of you. I agree with, you know, everything you've said on that. I'll close with a quick story about getting it wrong, which is a little bit humorsome, and I think it happens a lot, actually. You know, years ago, I worked at Cleveland Clinic Innovations, and I was going to angel investor meetings with a company that I ended up working for several years. But in their initial angel investor meeting, so this is pre-seed round, they were saying it would take $1 million to get through phase one to phase three of clinical trials. Scroll forward, you know, 9 years, and I had worked at the company for 6 years. We had burned $120 million and weren't done with phase three trials when I left and came back to Squire. So you can get it wrong. It shouldn't be laughable, and I'm not, I don't know if it was laughable at that point when they were saying $1 million, but, you know, you should have somebody kind of check your projections for, like, a reality check and make sure that they don't raise questions of, like, really, you can do that? Like, that timeline looks too fast. That money that you need looks too small. Before you go out to investors, and make sure it makes sense what you're proposing to do with the money and how much money you need to do it.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So that's it for our hour. So thank you very much, Rich and Marilee, for your assistance this, and your expertise this month.
Thanks for having us, Leo.
Yeah, we're out, and just a, you know, quick shout out. If anybody's, you know, has an instance where they want to have a soundboard against some financial folks in the space, you know, Marilee and I always love having, you know, conversations with folks just to hear what folks are up to, what the startups are looking to do, what the founders are trying to accomplish, and then. We're happy to be a soundboard in those cases as well.
Yeah, and from a legal side, I am as well. You know, I always say that a lot of the times, if you don't have enough money to pay for great advice from service providers, you probably do have enough money to buy somebody a cup of coffee and they'll listen to you. So, you know, please take that to heart. Now, coming up, we have a couple of events. We have a California Consumer Privacy event. At Squire, we have that's a webinar on October 17th. This is a new law that's applicable to anybody who plans to market to, sell to, or use data of a person in California. So it's going to affect almost all companies in the United States that are tech companies and online. And then our next Venture Law Meetup event is going to be Managing Your Board of Directors. The webinar for this event is Monday, November 4th, and then our in-person event is November 1st. Thank you, everybody.